Hi guys, how are you today? You good?
I feel a lot better because yesterday I got up at 3 o'clock in the morning to get a plane. So by the time I got here to teach, I've been starting teaching for you guys at 12 o'clock at night. Okay? So today I'm refreshed, so more energetic.
So, you've learned a lot about quality,
talking to Martin and guest lecturers. The focus today is looking at service quality. Now, do you remember yesterday we looked at quality and we noted that the quality delivered by personnel employed by the organisation is really important. So we're focusing on this area today. And I think this is where most companies fall down. They're good products, good ideas, but their service quality leaves something to be desired. And we are more sensitive to service quality, in my view, than any other aspect, because it is personal. It's not, the product is a bit abstract. We bought it, we paid money for it, it's a commercial transaction. And generally, we've looked at the product before we purchased, we've made a lot of decisions about it, whether we like this product or not. Today, most products are well made. They use quality systems. The products are good. Much, much better than when I was your age. Back then, quality standards were poor. For instance, televisions. People hired televisions when I was your age because they were so unreliable that when they broke down, you could phone up the company and say, pick up the TV, give me another. They were that bad. Yeah, you would expect a TV to break down. How many of you had a television break down? Two people. Okay? Used to be everything. Okay? But it still happens. I've never had a Japanese television ever break down. The reality is, the Japanese stole the TV market because Europe and America were rubbish at making TVs for the Japanese. Originally, the Japanese were only able to ship to the UK anyway, I'm not sure about Spain, what were known as portable televisions. I bought one of these Japanese portable televisions. Believe me, I think it weighed about as much as you. Okay? Portable? Well, not really, but it had a handle. Okay? And that meant it was a portable. So, products have really improved. What hasn't improved to the same standard is service quality. It's difficult because it depends on the people who work for you. And often, this doesn't really work as well as it should. So that's the focus of today's lecture. So, we want to be successful as a business. So we need to compete not only in the quality for our products, but the quality of our service that we provide with the product. Even companies like ABB, an engineering company, they view that their asset is the service that they provide to their customers. It's complicated equipment for running steel mills and other big capital-intensive industries. But I have a friend who works for ABB. The smallest order that he ever brings in is £1 million. It's a small order. Yeah. Usually, last year, he brought in £350,000 worth of orders. One guy, £350,000. And this is steel mills in India and China predominantly, but also the equipping other steel mills. He wins the orders on the basis that he promises that he is going to make sure that they get really good service quality. If they don't understand how something works, he will organise it so that somebody is there training, even though the original training was done, they will do it again. If something breaks down, he will have their service engineers there. They will call him up. He made a promise, and he makes sure that they deliver on that. He is by far the most successful sales manager that they have, because he's focusing in on this service element. They trust him. He's a Scottish man, and I find it difficult to understand him. I don't know how his customers understand him, because he talks like a machine gun. Da-da-da-da-da-da-da. He talks really fast. But put a beer in him and he slows down, okay? So he sells when he has dinner with his customers, because
Everybody else sells on technology, ours is the best, and the rest of it. He sells it on service. Their kit is good, but their service quality is exceptional. Mainly to do with the fact that he will make it happen for his customers. So, even in manufacturing companies, it's important.
So, which company are you talking about?
ABB.
ABB.
Which one is that? This used to be originally a Swiss company. They bought companies in the UK, Australia, and so on. They are one of the largest engineering companies in the world. You don't know them because they don't sell products to you or me. They sell them to industry, okay? So this is business to business. So, you will be familiar with this little diagram here, okay? Resources go into a process and you get an output for the customer. What is different in most systems is that you do have a service encounter. You talk to somebody before you buy. And in pure services, of course, it's all about the service encounter. If I was a psychologist and I was giving you tests, it would all be talking to me and me doing the tests and giving you feedback on those tests. There's no physical product, apart from the fact that I might do a report. But there's always an element of a service encounter. Sometimes it's really, really small, like an airline, minutes, okay? Other times, in more customized products, more complicated products, there's a lot of it. So this impacts on the service process. So how do we think about quality in this context? First of all, we have to redefine the way we think about specification of the product. We don't talk about the product, we talk about the service package. The package that we're presenting to the customer. The next slide will show you how to break that down into its components. We have to establish measures of performance for each of the elements in that service package. Not just the product part, the service part as well. We monitor the service process and output achievement. So we have another output here, because we find out from the customer what kind of ways, well, we can survey customers. I recently bought a new exhaust for my car from QuickFit. I don't know if you have it in the UK, but it is a company that specializes in replacing exhausts and tires in cars. I got home in the evening at about 7 o'clock, you know, it was about in the morning, the car had been repaired. I got a phone call, and it was, introduced itself, you bought a new exhaust system from us today. Will you spare us a minute to give us feedback on your experience? And they asked me a series of questions. A lot of it was the service element. How did you find your first contact with personnel? Are you satisfied, very satisfied, and so on and so on. What did you think of the waiting room? What did you think of the facilities that were there in the waiting room? How was the progress of your repair dealt with? Did you at all times understand how long you would wait? And so on. Okay? Took a minute. They are grabbing that feedback from customers so that they can feed it back to the individual service centres, but also the centre, so they can compare one centre local with another, so that they can give a prize to the one that is the best. And for those that are not so good, they put in training and put people into the ones that are the best to show how it is done in practice. So, we have problems, and because of the kind of feedback that we've got, like I've explained, we identify the reasons for non-conformance. As a result of that, we take corrective action. And this may be in terms of resources, it's the people that are actually involved, because they are the dominant resource here. Maybe the physical product we're buying in from somebody else. And finally, we have this arrow here. Service encounter itself. We are going to concentrate quite a bit of this lecture on this interaction in the service encounter and put forward some ideas about how we can best deal with the problems that we have, but also how we can avoid problems. So, here's an example for a supermarket. Of the service package. Up here we have the supporting facility. So this is the physical part of the supermarket, the car park, the supermarket itself. Then we have facilitating goods. Facilitating goods, these are the things that help but are not central to the service. An example here would be shopping trolleys. The explicit service, this is why we go to the supermarket to buy things. And finally, we have the implicit service here. So, the attribute, the way that we think about quality, attributes are things that are on scale, okay, whereas there's others that are yes, no. Okay, so let's look at the attributes. For the supporting facility, it's all about our impression of this. So, we are looking at the building's appearance. We have a rota which says that a manager goes around the supermarket and looks at it as if he's a customer. He arrives in a car, he doesn't go to the special place that we normally park in, he would go as if he was a customer. He goes and he gets a trolley and he puts a coin in the trolley. He looks at the supermarket as he's approaching it and he notices the appearance of the car park. Was there a car park space for him? Was the cafe open? Was it clear what it was selling? All of these things. So you have a checklist because supermarkets have lots and lots of different sites. People have thought about what should be on that checklist. So they're looking at it as if they're a customer. And suddenly you see things that you haven't seen before. So just to show you how blind people can be, I went to a restaurant, not today, I went to a good restaurant today, but the day before, at lunchtime, I went to this restaurant in the old town. There's some good restaurants there, there's some different restaurants, and there's some that really let themselves down. Not on the core product, but on the supporting facility. I sat down with my wife, she's over here with me, and took me a short holiday afterwards, and the first thing we noticed was that we were next to the window, and the glass, up to a certain level, was obscure, okay? And we could see food marks on the glass, because people are eating close to it, somebody's eating a sauce, a little bit goes on there, another customer has another little bit, should be cleaned every day. Then we started looking more carefully. We looked down and there was ledges around the windows. They were dusty and dirty. When I went to the toilet, it was not very clean. It was okay, but it was not the way it should be. So you start looking at these aspects and you say, I will not go back to this restaurant, because if this is the way it is in the restaurant, what is it like in the kitchen? And I'm eating that food. Now the food was fine, it wasn't special, it was okay. The service was good, I would say, on the whole it was reasonably good, people were nice. It was slow, very slow, yet there weren't very many people in the restaurant. So the combination of things is you would never go back there. Okay? So appearance does count. They are there every day. The proprietor, his wife, family that work there, and they are blind to these things. So it's really important that we do have this check, because you just don't notice it anymore as a customer. So, obviously, to put it right, you know, we need to repair, repaint, and so on. So the measurement is, you have a look and you sort of say, okay, yeah, the paintwork isn't brilliant, but we will have to replace it in a month's time so that we anticipate this. Car park spaces. Well, in the UK, car parking is a problem. I don't know if you have the same problem in Girona, but everywhere you are charged for car parking, except in supermarkets. So if you have a supermarket which is close to a town, people park in the supermarket and they go to shop elsewhere. So you can measure what percentage is usage by customers. By observation, you don't have to measure every customer, but by sampling, you can do this. The cafe, value for money compared to competitors in the town. So, all of these, you know, putting it right. Notice clamping for those who don't use it. Notices saying, you know, you have free parking for 2 hours if people don't leave their car there for the day and so on. So, facilitating goods. Well, you all must have had this, guys. You get to the supermarket, you get a trolley, and you start walking with the trolley. The trolley wants to go this way, and you want to go this way. I don't know what it is about me, but I always seem to either pick up bad trolleys, or there's a lot of bad trolleys there. Okay. Now, some of them seem to be okay. They go in the right direction until you've got them full of shopping. And then they want to go off in a particular direction. So what we should have is people collect trolleys where they're left, and we should put repair tags on those that are not running smoothly. So they're quarantined and they are repaired. So you're putting somebody to be responsible. There's somebody who is experiencing pushing those trolleys as they collect them. Customers complaint. So obviously monitor complaints, and this helps as well. Explicit service. Well, this is what we went to the supermarket for. We were buying our shopping. Simple enough. So we expect stock to be in good condition, particularly fresh food. We go through the groceries and we look at the food. It should look as if it's just been picked off a tree or out of the field. That's the way it should look. We also have a lot of products, something like 25,000 products. Have you got all of those products on the shelf? Now, we have to be reasonable. Fresh products. We want to run out of products, or some of them anyway, by the end of the day. Because if we don't, we have to throw them away. So we monitor this very, very carefully. We don't want to have stuff that we throw away, but at the same time, we want to keep availability right through to the end. So think about yogurts, for instance. They've got a certain life. There's a range of different yogurts. You want to be sure that at least one of the yogurts in the category, it might be a strongly flavored yogurt, is available for the customer. But not every one of the five that you offer, because that would be wasteful, because you would be throwing those away. So we have a service level target we're going to meet. So we have daily checks. We have mystery shoppers. Do you know what we mean by mystery customers? Yeah? Okay. So these people come in. Excuse me. Add us some water. As far as everyone in the store is concerned, a mystery shopper behaves like an ordinary shopper. There are specialist firms that do this, and most of them monitor more than one supermarket. They go in, they've got a checklist, it tells them what they're going to buy, specific items that they're going to buy, but they're also looking at things like car park spaces, signing in the aisles to find things. Can I find things quickly? Is the signing accurate? They always ask a member of staff to ask them where something is, so they measure the quality of that advice. Does the person stop what they're doing, take you there? That would be the highest mark. Give you a good explanation with the aisle number. That would get a lesser mark, but it still gets a mark. Or do they say, well, I'm not really sure. Can you ask another member of staff? Well, you know, you're going to be right down on the 0 mark. So, we also need to make sure that the product is actually there. People steal products from supermarkets. Unfortunately, about 2% of your products walk. That's a lot, isn't it? That's a lot of products that people steal. Now, the computer system, and you scan the stuff when you're going out, that is saying, okay, I'm supposed to have 550 of that, I take away one, I take away two. When somebody puts it inside this big coat, easy to do in England because it's cold, harder to do in Spain, somebody comes in with a great big coat, they think, yes, maybe this isn't an ordinary customer. But in the UK, it's really cold in the winter, and it's very wet, so people are wearing coats all the time. So, stock walks. When it walks, it's not available to customers. So you have to be checking on a round to say what is physically on the shelf as against what is on the shelf, and making stock adjustments. So somebody like Tesco, I know more about Tesco than any other supermarket because we have a special arrangement with them, because all of that information that comes through EPOS, somebody has a club card, this is a loyalty card, they put in their club card, they get points for this. The university gets all of this information, fantastic information, so you can actually say what kind of customers are buying different things, or PhD students, for instance, mainly marketing-related students, and they're looking at what is the effect of a particular promotion? Does it actually work? Is it cannibal in the sense that you promote one thing and you just sell less of another? because that is counterproductive, isn't it? So they do all of those things. So that's why I know so much about Tesco. So they are supposed to every week have checked everything that's in the store. Okay? Each member of staff will be allocated during the quarter times to go round and do a count. And they've got a little device which they can actually feed back to head office what that actual quantity is. So, we quarantine stock that isn't in good condition, so it's not available for customers. Getting the full range of products requires two things. Really good forecasting. And, of course, if we don't have the stock there, we need to amend the record. Now, do you remember yesterday we mentioned forecasting? Well, it's easy for Tesco because they are getting deliveries every day. Their aim is to replace every day. So, they only have to forecast a day ahead. Now, if you've got another kind of store, a clothing store, that's much more difficult because you're buying your stock on a season, so you've got to anticipate a long way in advance. So, in other industries, much more difficult. So, now we get the really important one. Now, I am quite a fussy shopper. I'm not that bothered by, to be honest, by the staff attitude in the supermarket, okay? Because the seconds that I spend with that person, as long as they do the job and they're not grumpy and they're not talking to a friend while I'm waiting, I'm not too bothered. Now, my wife is entirely different. She does most of the shopping, and if the staff don't treat her as if she's a person rather than treating her as somebody who's to be processed, she will not go back to that supermarket. Okay? And a lot of customers are like that. So this is really important. It is a difference because supermarkets ape one another. If you've got a supermarket that has a better implicit service by having better, more attentive staff, then you have got an advantage. So how do we do it in terms of information? Well, supervisor observation is one way. Yeah? We should be seeing an interaction with the customer. Tesco have a policy that train their individual operators to make eye contact with the customer. So this is important because this is you're viewing the person as a person. They're greeted. They're asked whether they want their bag packed. When the transaction is finished, they say, good day, right? And if the person is struggling with actually keeping up with the shopping and packing the shopping rather than it going through, they will stop that and they will help them with the shopping packing so that the process is balanced, because there's no point in lots of stuff going on and the person feeling under pressure. So they're very, very good at this. And because people are being monitored, they've been trained, they start to actually like talking to customers because they've made that eye contact. So there's some conversation. And what they do in Tesco is they've reduced the targets that individual operators have. You can measure how effective an operator is by their scan rate. How quickly can they scan the goods? Because this, when you've got a queue of people, is really, really important. They've reduced that because they're now accepting the fact that having some conversation with the customer, if they want it, is part of the overall experience. And it's worth having more operators so that you can have a little bit more time with the customer if they want to have conversation. Obviously, if there's a large queue, this is cut down. And the operator will say, oh, I'd love to finish talking to you, but I've got a lot of other customers waiting. So it's a conversation. It isn't something that is sort of cut off. So training, of course, is really, really important. We're going to talk about that later. So we can measure these things. Some are more difficult to measure than others. But our eyes, our senses, are very, very good at doing this. Once we start thinking as if we are a customer rather than thinking internally. So, research has been done predominantly in the US to look at what are the aspects of service that are important to customers. And when we display these here, they're in the order of importance to customers. And when I've talked to people in the supermarket industry about this, they're often quite surprised by the order of these things. I'm not, and maybe you shouldn't be either. First of all, we have something called reliability. Unfortunately, the researchers that did this were marketeers. They didn't realise that reliability meant something very specific in manufacturing. So they used this term. It isn't about time. Now, obviously, we use this word. Reliability is about quality and performance over time. Rather, they use this to describe whether things are actually being done dependably, the same every time, to the standard that's actually required. So, an illustration here, no mistakes in your transactions. So think about a bank. Every now and then, banks make mistakes. Some banks make more mistakes than others. And you get really, really annoyed about this, particularly if they charge you for something which isn't actually your fault, it's the bank that's actually done it. So being reliable in that way is obviously delivering the basics of the service that people are expecting. The next rows that come out are blue. These are all to do with the way the service encounter goes. First of all, we have responsiveness. Now, willing to help the customer promptly. I don't know if it's happened to you, but it seems to happen to me regularly. If I'm going around an electronic shop, you know, we have these electronic supermarkets in the UK, I'm sure you have them here too, and you know, you want to buy a small hi-fi for your office or something like this. And I look around and I sort of say, yeah, that's nice, that's nice, that's nice. And I'll go off and I'll look at another store and look at their stuff as well. Now, nearly every time I'm just looking to make my mind up about what I would possibly consider and what I wouldn't, somebody comes over and says, yeah, can I help you? And I say, no, I'm fine. I'll ask you, you know, when I'm actually ready to buy. Now, when that actually happens, when I've decided what I want to buy, I look around the store and I can't find anybody. They're not there, or they're in a clump of three members of staff. We're all talking to one another. You look towards them trying to make eye contact, and they're all sort of trying to keep out of the way and carry on with their conversation. You walk over, and they're still talking. So you put your hand on somebody's shoulder, and they turn around, you know, as if you've attacked them. And you say, I want your help. And they rather begrudgingly sort of say, and leave their friends and go off and help you. Okay? Now, obviously, this is not responsiveness. Very far from it. You wonder whether these people are thinking really about what their real job is. Yeah? For them, yeah, because there's a lot of time when they're not busy, they think, oh, well, you know, it doesn't matter. Yeah? If I'm not busy, I can talk. But you've always got to be keeping an eye out for customers and what they want, which means you've got to patrol the aisles. They don't. So responsiveness, assurance, trust and confidence is really important, particularly in services where we're unable to judge the quality. When we go to our doctor, this is really important. We are trusting his advice. We have knowledge of our condition, but we haven't got the technical knowledge to know what would be the right diagnosis for our condition. So we put trust and confidence there. The same is when we go to a lawyer or an architect, we're trusting in their competence. But in a broader context, think about aeroplanes. They are not supposed to crash, are they? Now, we do expect very, very high standards. What would be acceptable numbers of failure in other industries are just unacceptable in the airline industry. Now, luckily, the airline industry is a lot better than it used to be, but they used to produce tables of the number of incidents that they used to call, which basically means planes falling out of the sky, or crashing on landing, or not taking off properly and crashing at the end of the day. One airline had worse record than anybody else, and that was the Russian airline at the time, the USSR airline. And no one, with any sense, would go on their flights. They were cheaper. You know, you could fly on those flights cheaper than with any other airline, but no business people travel with them because they valued their lives. Yes?
Is aeroplane on flight right now?
Aeroplane, yes. Well, you're alive. This is a good sign. This is a good sign. But, you know, they didn't have that many crashes. They didn't have that many crashes, but there were more than other people.
Well, this is where we the turbo layer.
Yeah.
I
machines.
Yeah. Not in good condition.
Yeah. Well, they weren't well maintained. The planes were old.
Like, yeah, I flew with Boeing.
Yeah. But yeah, they've cleaned up their act because they were protected before, but now they've got to compete. They were subsidised. Now they've got to compete, so they know that they can't do what they used to do. So, yeah. It's not an issue now, but it used to be. So this assurance sometimes can be more physical. Empathy, the ability to be approachable, to listen. Now, the more professional the service is, the more important this is. Clearly, empathy, we're not expecting a lot of empathy from Ryanair. They have minutes of contact with us, we expect them to be polite, we expect them to be efficient, but empathy, we're not telling them their, our life story, right? We're not looking for a service which is complicated, but in many services, talking about what it is that you want, because in lots of services, people don't know what they really need. So you need a conversation which diagnoses what it is that customer is actually after. And when you get to the point where you deliver that, they said, that's exactly what I wanted. Okay, but they weren't able to express it. So you see all these in blue, these are all very people-oriented. Last, in red, is tangibles. The physical aspects of the service. And you see this is right down the bottom. Now, funny things. Yeah? Banking. Of course, it is all about service, isn't it? You expect reliability. Tangibles, they spend a fortune on their facilities. Yeah? They want a bank to look as if it's really important, that it's rich. So they have marble floors. Yeah? When they choose the wood, they sort of think, oh, no, I won't have that. They will have something expensive looking and so on. So they spend a lot of money on this, but customers don't care. They really don't care. So a lot of money is spent on this tangible aspect because people believe it is important. Much more important are the others. These people expect places to be clean, well-maintained and so on, but they don't expect them to be absolutely top-notch. If you're in a five-star hotel, different. But you don't have to have a fantastic banking hall. Now, we have in the UK a bank called the Cooperative Bank. We have cooperatives here, but we have a bank called the Cooperative Bank. And the Cooperative Bank don't have buildings which have been built for them. They use shops. The fittings that they have in the shops, they've designed so that they're modular. So they're the same for every branch. They just put them together, bolt them together, and there is a branch of the co-op. They put a standard sign outside which can be taken down, and they are more willing to have a go at being a bank in a town which hasn't got a bank, because they say, okay, we think we want to give a service to this particular community. And because their costs of setup are relatively low, they can do this. And if it doesn't work out, they take the equipment out of the bank, they take the sign down, and they will try somewhere else. They also have what are known as kiosk banks. These are like a sort of an octagonal thing which can go on the back of a lorry. Okay? And they put them on university campuses, on places which they can't afford to have staff permanently there. Off it comes from a truck. It's put down, the electrics and the telephone broadband connection is there. And people can come in and they can get money out, they can deposit money, and they have people, just like a cash machine, that come around, refurbish the cash back in the machine, take away the deposits and so on. And these have been highly successful, so that this bank has grown when most banks haven't. A different way of thinking. Because they've said to themselves, this isn't what it's all about. It is about offering a service which is wider. So we have something called moments of truth.
This term came from chief executive of Scandinavian Airlines, and he was very concerned about the fact that they were a small airline. How could they differentiate themselves from their competitors? Their prices, because they were a small airline, couldn't be lower. Their fleet had to be of the standard, which is the same as anybody else's. So there was no way on cost they could do it. So what they said at the time is, you know, the service element, this isn't always good. Let's rethink how we deal with our customers. We're not processing them.
We want to deliver service quality. And he called each one of the contact points between a customer and a member of staff of the airline as a moment of truth, whether you thought you got good service or not. Now, we know from our experience with airlines, these moments of truth are minutes and seconds. They're not hours. So each one is important. And there's a halo and horns effect. Do you understand what I mean by a halo? You know, a saint with the thing above, horns, or the devil, no? So if you have a halo experience in your first contact, you're positive about your next contact. If you have a horns experience, you're thinking, now you're more critical. Okay, so it's really important that you keep up the halo, okay? The first impression, a halo, the last impression, a halo, and you may be forgiven one horn experience in the middle. So, most services, of course, are multiple contact. Each one of those contact points, whether it's minutes or seconds, is a moment of truth. Supermarket example, the eye contact, the greeting, the willingness to help. These moments of truth are the way the customer judges quality of service. So this is what they were aiming to do at Scandinavian Airlines. Expectations of the customer, not your specifications, drive judgments. Now, the reality is, we as customers become more and more demanding. If service quality improves, but all of the people in the industry, then we expect that new standard, not the old standard that preceded it. So always this expectation is going up. Contact between you and the customer and customization make this very difficult to manage. Because you're relying on individuals to deliver this service. You can't control this face-to-face. It's often being done by your staff. Difficult to measure. The customer, however, makes that judgment. But we do have an advantage. The advantage is that recovery is easier. Because the customer is there, if they're not happy, if we are a good service provider, we can detect that the customer is not happy, and we can find out why the customer is happy and try to put it right. Now, I'm surprised, a couple of years ago, the American Academy of Management, which is in the US, but different cities, different years, and there's 5,000 academics of these dudes. And I went to one particular session, which I thought was very, very insightful. And it was looking at this moment of truth kind of idea, and when things went wrong, and recovery. And what it found was that customers, surprisingly, who were unhappy with the service that they were being provided with, if it was put right, and put right well, were actually happier at the end than the customers that got the service right in the first place. Because the service provider seemed to go out of their way to make sure that the customer was fully satisfied with what actually happened. Which does tend to suggest that a lot of customers come away unhappy about a particular service and they think that this is exceptional. And in fact, it should be routine. So, we do have an advantage. We're going to be talking about how to deal with that later. But it's not like manufacturing, it's not tucked away, it's not something that we can control at a distance.
You just said that it was hard to measure, yes. Especially when you depend on individuals. How do they detect it? How do they detect a customer, a designer, not satisfied?
It's difficult to do, isn't it? Some situations are much easier than others. The more your individual members of staff are separated and with the customer out of sight, the more difficult it is for any form of supervision. Okay? So you are relying on other means to find out. What you're trying to do is make sure that your staff are trained so that they realise that the customer isn't happy, because we are expecting our staff to try to do the best in the first place, but maybe it isn't right as far as the customer is concerned. It might have been what we expected to do, but the customer thinks differently. We need to know that. And as we will explain as we go through, we need to train our staff and select our staff so that they're able to deal with this particular problem. Okay? So we empower our staff to be able to try and put things right. Okay? So it is more difficult to measure. At a distance we can measure customer satisfaction surveys like the telephone call that I got. But of course, I've already had the service. If I was unhappy, there's no opportunity to put it right. Yeah. So because somebody is there with the customer, they can detect whether that customer is happy or not. Think about the restaurant. Yeah. This isn't done well, but it can be done well. That the person who is serving comes back after the meal has been provided and asks whether everything is okay. Now, I notice that the staff are trained to do this, but you guys are having a meal at U4, okay? I've served you, I've took your orders, I've delivered your food. Later on, I come back, okay? You're busy eating. I come back and I say, everything all right? And you know, I've delivered the statement, but I haven't paused, looked at your eyes, and you can detect whether somebody is unhappy, and maybe you're unhappy, but you thought that the standard of the food wasn't particularly right, or that we actually didn't do it the way you liked, the steak perhaps, or whatever. But by having an eye contact with each person, you're saying, is it all right with you? Is it all right with you? Is it all right with you? And you say, great, I'm glad you're happy. And if people still got face, you know that they're not really happy, and you need to carry on to find out what the problem is. Okay? Because people sometimes are unwilling to complain. You want people to complain. Later on we'll talk about one of the means which can help to do that. So let's we know, we've got it right. That's the thing. So here, we've got a cycle of failure. This is what a lot of services businesses that fail are like. It's a great shame, but you know, I look around Girona and there's a lot of shut-up shops. Okay? I go to the UK, different cities, there's a lot of shut-up shops. Which ones are the ones that shut down? It's either because of financial incompetence, and this is widespread with small businesses, unfortunately. They buy too much stock, they don't control their cash, they think the bank will always lend them money, and when that stops, bang. You know, they mortgage their houses to get money and say, oh yeah, everything's okay, and then they run out of money again. A lot of the time, it is because they're not offering value and service to the customer. You've always got to be delivering what customers want. That restaurant, the dirty restaurant, the only reason it survives is tourists. They go in there once, they will never go there again. I'm sure no local goes there at all, because they've been there once and they say, yeah, it's a dump, don't go there. Okay? So they survive, but they're in a really good spot in the old town. They should be full every lunchtime. They should be. Instead, they've got somebody out on the street trying to persuade people to come in. That's usually a sign of a business that isn't getting it right. People should be willing to do that. So, what is it that goes wrong? Well, first of all, we have the employee cycle, the way our employees are. First of all, there is a tendency to think that one of the ways to make money in a service is to pay relatively little and to get people to do a relatively narrow job. That is, that it hasn't got a lot of discretion. So, the design of the job is narrow. The things that you're expecting of the person, you can train them in a day. You have rules. This is what you can do, this is what you can't do. You have scripts. This is what you're supposed to say. You have technology to control quality. You monitor if you can.
Yeah.
Supermarkets used to monitor the old keystrokes that were going through, and anyone who was on the bottom of the pile in terms of speed, they'd bring them in and they'd say, you know, really, you're not cutting the mustard. You're not good enough. Unless you improve your performance by the end of the week, you're out. That's the way it used to be. Now, they think in terms of, okay, what are they like in customer service? And it may be that they're exceptional in customer service. And you say, well, okay, now this is somebody who's delivering on something else. So what you do is try to get the balance right, so they spend less time talking to the customer. So, we pay low wages. We don't make much of an effort to select our staff because we don't expect them to stay very long. Employees become bored. The jobs are relatively narrow. The rules are there saying what they can and can't do. You tend to have a poor service attitude. This reflects, and we'll see a slide later to explain this, to actually mean that the person who's actually receiving the service thinks that as well. Now, you need a positive, motivated employee to be able to make sure that your customer feels that they're getting good service. So you get high employee turnover, poor customer service. This, in the wider way, it means that you get customer dissatisfaction, less continuity, people don't come back, you have no customer loyalty. This means you have high customer turnover. So you have an emphasis on getting new customers. And this really worries me. I don't know if you have the same thing. But in the UK, yeah, I take out my car insurance. I do it online because I can get a low price because I can compare the different companies. So I've selected a particular company. Every year, without fail, that company will always have a higher price when they renew the policy. And they make excuses for it and what have you. And, you know, I'm somebody who will say, okay, I will spend 20 minutes on the internet to find another company. Some people say, oh, no, I can't be bothered, I haven't got the time, and they renew. So what they're doing is they're offering lower prices to new customers than to customers they've already got. Every time somebody clicks through on Google or a comparison site, they are paying money. Company that's had the contact is paying money. This can be anything from 1p a click to £500 a click if it's a mortgage. So you think it's all free, but the person who is actually getting listed on Google, getting listed on the comparison site, the number of clicks that they get through that actually takes them through to the end customer, that click, you're on the top of the list on Google. Okay, you've got this zone that you know is a different colour on Google. They're paying to be there. Okay, they're also, everyone on that list, down in the 500s to the hundreds of thousands of other listings that are at the bottom, everyone is paying for a click. So that's how Google make their money. You click on that, whether it's a comparison site or directly to the company, and Google get money. Now, some businesses have been put out of business by rivals. You've got a store, I've got a store. And what I do is when I'm not busy, I go onto Google and I click on yours. I click again, and I click again, and I click again. And you say, what? You know, I haven't got any business. And I say, well, you know, I'm sorry, you know, that's the way it works. Yeah? But Google will, you know, identify this as being, you know, sort of erratic behavior, because you don't expect click, 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 click. You do expect a more random element to it. But, you know, people are paying for these click-throughs. So a comparison site will pick Google. Then the comparison site is paid when it goes through to their individual site. So you've got the listing there, you go off and you look at the detail for a particular company. They pay for that click, whether you use them or not. So they're paying money to attract customers that are new at lower prices. Now, I phone up these companies and I say, look, I've been on the net. I can get, as a new customer, a renewal at a lower price than you've given me. Some of the companies say, well, I'm sorry, that's the way it works. And I go, okay, forget it. There's a few companies that have a price promise. Now, price promises that they will meet any price of identical insurance. And you say, well, actually, it's your own insurance. And they go, ah. Okay? Crazy, isn't it? They're paying money for new customers, and they're not rewarding existing customers. This is bad news, really bad news, because loyalty means you have less money to spend on the customer. You don't have to set up their account. There's less admin. So it's a crazy world. And the insurance industry, unfortunately, it's got a mindset which is a marketing mindset rather than an operations one. So, low profit margins, generally a bad thing. So, this is what is known as the satisfaction limit. Now, I am not very happy with the term mirror, because this is glass that you can look through, because the customer can see the employee can see the customer, so it's not a mirror. But what they're really saying is that the behaviour of one reflects onto the behaviour of the other. So let's just look at this. Higher customer satisfaction leads to higher employee satisfaction. Why? Well, the more familiar you are with the customer and their needs, the more repeat purchases you will get. So in a bank, a good bank, if you go to the branch of the bank, you hand over perhaps a deposit, and they immediately know your name because it's on that bit of paper. From there on, they talk to you as Mr. Dick, okay? Or Dr. Dick, or whatever is on there. Okay? So, familiarity means more repeat purchases. The more people are familiar with the service, the more likely they are to complain, which means you have a better opportunity to put things right. Whoops, I've jumped in here. Come back. This, because we're not spending money on attracting new customers, means we have lower costs. This means overall we have higher productivity, we have an improved service quality, and overall better results. So, employees that have happy customers have a nice day. They enjoy it. Employees who have dissatisfied customers come away at the end of the day and go, you know, dealing with customers. The reaction in the brain, the psychological reaction to this, is to distance yourself from the feelings of the customer. It's not your fault. Now, that's the way customers are. So you end up with this disassociation between the employee and the customer. What we want is the opposite of that, where the employee wants to really satisfy the customer, and you smile at somebody, they will smile back. You're nice to somebody, they're nice to you back. You're abrupt with somebody, and they will be abrupt to you back. So good behaviour, good eye contact, indicating that you're enjoying the experience is going to mean that the customer enjoys the experience. And what they found, this was done in banking again, tends to be an easy area to research in terms of this kind of thing, and you have willing banks to do it because they are trying to improve their customer service. The banks that have higher customer satisfaction also have high employee satisfaction. That's complicated. One helps the other helps him, because you get positive feedback from your customers, which helps you to be positive for the next customer. So, we get to the crunch. How do we make sure that we have employees who can do the job, that deliver on this kind of service? Well, we have something called the cycle of capability. First of all, we have to select our employees carefully. Some people are naturals at customer interaction. Some people just haven't got it, okay? Just haven't, it's not in their nature. These people might be great technically, might be great to work in a factory or in an office where they're not in contact with a wide range of customers, because they just don't have that kind of empathy. Some people are really good at this, and you can detect this, but it's not something you can detect in an application form. You have to do it differently. More of this later. We need high quality training. That training has to deal with how you deal with problems as well as how you deliver on the job. You need to have good support systems.
You've got to have technology that supports supervisors and they know what they're doing and support and so on.
You need empowerment, but limited empowerment. You're not letting people do anything that they want, but you're giving them discretion. Discretion to put things right. Excuse me.
This, of course, makes the job more interesting because you're giving people more responsibility.
You put limitations on the expectations of employees. What this means is you make sure that this empowerment, it's not rule-bound, but you make it quite clear how far they can go and what they're expecting of them and where they draw the line when they bring in a supervisor or whatever. So it's very, very clear how far you go. You want appropriate rewards and recognition. Service industries are famous for paying low wages. Those low wages generally go with poor service.
So paying more money. Wider jobs, the hotel example, I think is a good one. Impeccable service, you get that from people who are experienced, who know what they're doing, and also that you know that they have a past record of being able to do it really well.
So, you need to recognise those. And you need to also make clear that it's something you are monitoring. So you have the employee of the month, which is based not on productivity, but is based on feedback from customers, service satisfaction. We end up with more satisfied employees. They, in turn, are very positive about working for a particular company, and they're willing to refer friends to the company. Now, you might think that sometimes this might be a very good idea, referring friends or family to work in a particular company. But what you're actually doing is you are, as an employee, you're saying, I think you are the kind of person that will be quite happy working in this company. You never say to a friend, you know, that you think is really, you know, they're great about some things, but they are not good with people. You don't say to them, come and work for this company, because you know that expectation of the company is that is what's required.
So, we have here the service profit chain. And this framework here is a famous framework which explains how we connect the cycle of capability, the satisfaction mirror, to being able to achieve loyalty. Now, in this particular diagram, the arrows are going in this direction, from employees through to end results. Now that is when you've got an existing organisation and you're evaluating it or you're monitoring it. But if you're setting up a new organisation, a way of thinking about the vision, the strategy, is to start at this end with the arrows going this way. Okay? So if you are ever setting up a business, which is a service-orientated business, reverse the arrows. It will help you to clear your thinking on how to have a strategy which is going to deliver the service that you want. So, we have employees, we've learned about the cycle of capability, we've learned about the satisfaction mirror, and we have a cycle. So, loyalty of employees and service quality, these are the elements of this. We're not going to go through all of them because we're going to deal with them this week. Okay? They're there for you to look at them another time. So, this leads to better productivity of our employees and better output quality for customers. This, in turn, we have a service concept. This is, you know, in marketing terms, you know, what is the unique service proposition we've got? What is the service package that's going to deliver on it? When we talked about the service package earlier. So, we want high service quality, we want low cost. The service delivery system here, using the cycle of capability, using the satisfaction mirror, is giving us extra productivity, even though we're paying a little bit more money for it. So this delivers service value. That's the way we as customers judge the total package. We talked about sort of order winners and order qualifiers. In our brain, we have this idea of service value. It's great, but it's too expensive. We say these kind of things in our daily lives, don't we? Yeah, I like it, but I can't afford it. So you have a balance, don't you? Now, if you can have something which is really, really good at a lower price than your competitors, you have an order winner. Customers will flow to your door because you're offering them value, real value. So we have a target market. We want our customers to be satisfied and we want them to be loyal. That gives us revenue, growth and profitability. Think about this. Are we somebody who says the customer is king? Well, should you? But here's a thought for you. A good service concept has got particular kinds of customers as its target. You cannot satisfy all but possible customers and deliver that service value. You have to know the customers that you are targeting and be willing to say to those people that are asking something which is outside of what you can do, to say, we don't do that. This is a customer that doesn't fit your profile. And they may be unhappy, but they're not a customer that you want to have. Now, customers that are rude, customers that don't pay their bills, customers like this, you don't want to have in any business. You just do not want to have these. But you also don't want to have customers who are exceptionally demanding. Not demanding in terms of wanting the service quality that you're delivering, but expecting you to do things that are different. We'll talk about that in a bit later. So, you can see the arrows going this way. But if you were thinking about, I want to achieve this kind of revenue and growth, what kind of customers do I want to target? What is my focus? What is my demographic for those customers? What is it that they really need? What are the order-winning and order-qualifying criteria for those? This then becomes your service concept. This is what you are trying to deliver. Your service package, say this. And then you have to think about the operation. How do I actually deliver this? So this cycle of capability is important. So I hope that helps sort of put the thing into context. So, internal quality drives employee satisfaction. Zero. Employee satisfaction drives retention and productivity. Capability cycle. Retention and productivity drives our customer value. Service value drives customer satisfaction. And customer satisfaction drives loyalty. Loyalty drives profitability and growth. Xerox, their products are not the cheapest in the market. Far from business to business products. Yet Xerox are a very successful company. It is on service quality. Their service quality is really good. And some research said that when you actually look at individual firms and look at loyalty, loyalty really does reduce costs dramatically. So for credit card companies, think about the cost of setting up an account against the cost of running the account. The setting up of the account requires individual effort, monitoring the data that you've got from a particular customer. Are they somebody you want to give a credit card to? Once you've got them, it's all automated. So your costs are much, much lower. So keeping customers drives up profitability. And research showed anything from 25 to 85% profitability of customers that were loyal customers. They also have the quality of market share. You want customers who are loyal. That's the quality of the share. Not the size of your market, but the quality of it is such a vital thing. Now this loyalty thing, here's the Xerox example. They have customers who they call apostles. These are six times more likely to repurchase than others. And how do these apostles behave? These are people that go around saying how great Xerox is. So they are salesmen for Xerox, which is a great thing to have. So, we need to select people carefully. So, we don't have an emphasis on application forms. We have that for the data that it gives, because we're going to need that at a later point. But abstract questioning, where you don't ask a specific question, but you say, perhaps you know, your you're going to be employing somebody in a retail shop selling clothes. You know, you start a process, you know, sort of, what do you think about trends in fashion? Find out whether they're the kind of person who's going to be able to talk to the customer in a way which is knowledgeable. And then, you know, this warms them up. So you say, you know, sometimes you've got really difficult customers, how do you deal with this?
Yeah.
And you find out more and more of this sort of abstract kind of questioning, which is not asking specific questions, but open questions. We can also use situational vignettes. You're going to do one in a minute. Okay, this is a little case study, and you say, well, how do you deal with this particular problem? You do role play. This.
What does vignette mean?
Oh, we'll do one in a minute. You'll see exactly what it means. Okay? You're going to be, to see if you can be selected to be a coffee shop manager. Okay? Using a vignette. Vignette is like a good story. You sort of say, well, how would you deal with this situation? Okay? So role-playing. Some companies do this, and it can work reasonably well, but it is quite intensive. So this is for bigger companies, where you're going to have an event once a month where you bring in prospective employees and your HRM people, put them in role-plays that have been worked out before that you've used on other times and so on. But for smaller companies, impossible really to make it work. Training. Well, we want technical skills. We want people to know what it is that they need to do to be able to do the job well in terms of the technical aspects. But then we need to give them training on how do they deal with unrealistic customer expectations, unreasonable demands of those that are against policy. You want to be able to deal with these in a way that leaves the customer not feeling that they're not being served, but knowing why it is that it can't be served. So, for instance, some people are pretty much against pasteurised milk. There's a lot of people in the UK that will not drink pasteurised milk. They want milk as it comes out of the cow. Now, for health and safety reasons, you cannot do this in a cafe or a restaurant because there is a risk of TB, tuberculosis, which is a very nasty condition. Okay? That's why it's pasteurised, to get rid of the germs that are in the milk. But in doing that, also takes out some of the very good things that are in milk, which are very good for you and for me. But it's a balance of risk. So that would be an example. Unacceptable customer behaviour. This, of course, is a problem in bars and restaurants commonly. But it can happen in other situations as well. So you need to have your employees trained so they can deal with this well without being angry with the customer, but in a way that is professional and will minimise the effect of this customer behaviour on your other customers. This is the most common problem. Service failure. Unavailable service. You've got something on a menu and it's not available. So you suggest an alternative. Slow or poor service. This can be a real problem. Busy times. It's going to happen. Okay? Because it's very, very difficult to judge how much your demand is going to be at any moment in time. But if you've got good means of dealing with these service failures, as that research showed, customers can end up being even happier than if they had good service in the first place. So, this is a situational vignette. So, work on this in twos or threes, you know, so where there's four of you, break up into twos, where there's three, work together, okay? And discuss your ideas. This is a little coffee shop called the Amaretto Coffee Shop. It's a small coffee shop, it's a successful coffee shop, and we are looking for a new store manager. And this is the situational vignette that we're giving candidates when they come in. And we're giving all this, and we're giving them 20 minutes to think about it, and then we ask them to talk about it. I'm going to give you about that amount of time to be able to do it as well. So here's a problem. We have a good customer, but he has this very irritating habit of showing up about 5 minutes before we close. And each month we have a store meeting. Sorry, each week we have a store meeting, which is held after closing time. Your staff have got other lives. You know, you close at 6 o'clock. They want to catch a train to go to pick up their children from a baby mind or whatever. But they are willing to stay on
a little bit later.
But they want to get away on time. So it means that we want to shut the shop on time. So this customer, because they come in late, it means that the meeting is delayed and it stops everyone from going ahead.
Don't have them on time.
So how should you manage this shop to avoid this happening for this customer and for other potential customers who arrive late? So over to you guys, see how you do.
So the problem is that the customer stays more than the time.
Yeah, so he's has his coffee, the particular customer doesn't drink his coffee hot, he likes to sit there, enjoy waiting for his coffee to cool down, and then he drinks his coffee and he's off. But he always comes just before we close and spends 10 minutes in the store rather than going on time. How do we deal with it? Think about your own personal experience as well as thinking about this particular problem. Remember, this is a management problem. How do you manage the store to avoid this kind of situation being prior? Up to you guys. Okay, guys. Remember, this is about recruitment, okay? So what we're looking for is a reason kind of approach, which has got a number of different aspects. And funny enough, if you add all your ideas together, this would be a very good interview. But individually, you know, the ideas are rather restricted. So you know, one of the ideas, the obvious one, is you put a notice on the door saying that we're closing in 5 minutes, and you have something at the door, to let your existing customers out and say thank you to them. But you know, when new customers do come, you turn them away. Even better than that, if you can say, up until perhaps a minute when you actually want to shut, you say, we're just offering a takeaway service today. Would you be happy with that? And you organise that so that people are in and out. So you're recovering from the situation of the customer who's displeased by the fact that they're not able to come out. So, these would be good solutions. You also want to signal to your customers that you are close to the existing customers who are at the store. And one of the ideas was to have some broadcast announcement with a microphone. But there's definitely a certificate, isn't there? We all know the sort of signals that we've had if we stay very, very late in a restaurant or something. We noticed that the staff are putting their chairs up on their tables that are empty. That they start doing sweeping. And then, you know, when they're sweeping around you, you know it's time to leave. Lights can be dimmed in areas where there's no service, and eventually you can actually get to the point where you are going to put out lights. But all of these are signals. You don't have to say anything. You're actually sort of showing that we are closing up. Now, what about our individual customers? Some people have ideas. It's like you know, just talking to the government and sort of saying, no, today we're closing early. We hope you understand, but we've got to close on time. Now, of course, this guy is a bit sort of in his own world anyway. You know, that he every time he comes, he stays later than he should, but he's used to doing it. So I think what we have to do here is we have to accept the fact that it's more likely than not customer is going to say, yeah, and you will just continue to sit there longer than you really want. So at some point, you say, we're actually closing now. Can we offer you a takeaway coffee because you haven't been able to finish your coffee? Or you know, you have tables outside, you could leave a table outside. You could say, please, you know, sit outside, enjoy your coffee. You won't be charged for it today. So you're recovering the situation and saying, you know, we understand you want to spend time. An ingenious idea, which didn't come up today, but I've heard before, is inviting you to a staff meeting. This would probably have a dramatic effect. For example, oh, no, we want to do that. But, you know, if you did, you would say yes. You've got a customer there, haven't you? And if you say, you know, we're not expecting you to say say anything, but no, during the meeting we're going to say, as a customer, are there things you would like to say about how we could improve our service? And, you know, he could feel part of that process. Most of it would be pretty boring because it's about rotors and things like that. So, it's an idea, isn't it?
But if he says, I want your employees to stay late until I finish my coffee?
When you say,
we go back to the same problem.
Well, you go back to the same problem. But, you know, if you take away his coffee and give him a takeaway coffee and you're holding it, you're not giving it to him, you're leading him to the door, coffee and he's... We open the door, you put the coffee outside, it's just like... I'm joking. It's actually a cartoon, isn't it? But, yes. No. It's actually the individual customer. Yeah, it's just here to sort of get things started. Ideally, what you want to have is a system that's in place that everybody understands, which means that you have a closing down sequence, which means that you're not allowing new people into the store to sit in and have a coffee. It's just a takeaway service and so on those days that you do it. There were ingenious ideas about discounts. A happy hour at the back here. I'm all for happy hours, why not? But I'm not sure that you can have any sort of special offers which are just unique to a particular day in the week. Customers don't understand this. It's much better to have something which you can customers get used to, so you can have a happy hour every day where coffee prices were lower. Obviously you want to have that earlier to draw your demand in, but the coffee market isn't really like that. People aren't worried about the price of the coffee because it's not a lot. So these kind of incentives on the whole don't work. If they do work at all, it is by offering some kind of different service at another time of the day. But perhaps people would come in for a cup of tea and coffee, but it's a quiet time where you offer them a cake, a muffin. Okay, so you know, free cake, blah 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 blah. Done by some. So I think probably some of you are going to pass the test. And, yeah, but it is the fact that you're thinking about it, getting beyond the individual customer that really counts here, thinking about the system, how you would deal with this. Anyone who was already in the industry would know the things that we've talked about anyway. So you're testing that they've got the kind of experience that you would expect for a coffee shop. So you've got the job. Which is great. Now, things don't go right. The customer is dissatisfied. We can have the customer go, shrugs his shoulders, and takes no action. But if action is taken, it falls into different categories. There's action in the public arena, and there's action in the private arena. So, if you complain inside the firm and say, no, I'm not happy, and you explain the problem, this is what we mean by seeking redress directly from the firm. We can take legal action at extremes. You know, we talked about coffee shops, you're not going to take legal action over a coffee, you're being chucked out. But if you have spent a considerable sum of money on a contract and it hasn't been delivered to the standards that you require, you would perhaps consider legal action. And if you're really unhappy about the response that you've got when you try to get redress from the firm, you could go to an agency. It could be an agency which is a public agency. For instance, in the UK we have something called the Trading Standards Agency. So if you think that you have got less than you should have done, but you consistently get something under a kilo when you buy something by a kilo, you can go to Trading Standards and they'll go in and they'll check their scales and what have you, and they will prosecute the person if they tamper with the scales or their own kind of measuring. They will also look at other kinds of complaints which are to do with statements that are untrue. So they say something and they don't actually do it. We also have business agencies that people belong to, which are a group of people that have come together to say, in this business, you know, we are the reliable people. We have this little shield which says you are a member of such and such an organisation. Then we have private action. To stop buying the product or boycotting the seller by just ignoring them in the future, and warning friends about the product or
the seller. Which one of these do you think is the most common?
Private action?
Yeah. Which do you think is the second? I'm sorry, within private action, which of these? Stop buying the product or warning friends?
I think it's both. One, the first one, or both?
Well, that's covering your bets.
Pardon?
That's covering your bets. Both.
No, because if you stop buying the product, you warn your friends. You don't warn your friends and not buy the product.
Maybe we will see that it's different from that. Public action, do you think this is much less than private action?
You do. Well,
you have a slide which tells you actually which are the most common, and we're going to look at that. Here is a little chart. This stands for slightly dissatisfied. This is annoyed. This is very annoyed. This is extremely annoyed. And this is absolutely furious. Okay? So these are ways of describing your level of dissatisfaction. Now, let's look at it. It forms into two groups, doesn't it? We've got ones that start even when you're slightly dissatisfied. And we've got others that are much more linear. Which are the ones that start when we're slightly dissatisfied? Well, if we look at the one that is the most common, it is telling friends. So this obviously is important. But not using it again, you can see that even when you're slightly dissatisfied, you might continue to use it. So it is more common to complain to friends and what have you, telling friends about it. Now this, of course, is really important because this is like negative publicity, isn't it? And you tell somebody about your dissatisfaction and they may then tell somebody else and then tell somebody else. So if it was a restaurant in Girona, for instance, and this restaurant, yeah, I complained to you as a friend, you know, that it's dirty and what have you, you would say, you know, Gavin went to this friend, unbelievable, it's really dirty and the rest of it. And they say, you know, you don't want to go to that restaurant, it's got a really bad reputation, and so on and so on. So it goes on. The other one, which starts at quite a high level, is actually complaining in the firm. Now, people do complain. And we can see here about 50% are willing to actually complain. But unfortunately, put that round the other way. There's 50% of people who are slightly dissatisfied or annoyed or very annoyed or extremely annoyed. Now, we're getting up into the 80s or whatever, but there's a lot of people who are not complaining to the firm. We want people to complain so we can put it right. So we need a system for doing that. We're going to look at that in a moment. Okay? So, things which are at the minimum, complaining against, this is when you are actually complaining to a business agency or something like that. You've got to be absolutely furious. So, we can see that this is very, very common, telling friends and complaining. We want people to complain, we want more people to complain, but how many friends do they tell, depending on how annoyed they are? The next slide tells us this. Slightly annoyed, I tell 5 people. Very annoyed, it's going up and up. So when we're absolutely furious, we tell a lot of people. Now, I have considerable power because as a lecturer, I speak to a lot of people, and I am more than willing to complain about things that I'm not happy about. So, I have a service dog on my car with a clutch broken. I put it into the garage. It was a dealership, so they should have known what they were doing. And later on, I took the garage to somebody else, my local guy, who does my servicing for me. And he said, "Who put in this clutch for you?" And I said, "Well, it was done by the main dealer." He said, "This is absolutely disgusting." And he took me under the car and he showed me what a botched job had been done. There was leaks, oil leaks. There were seals that were broken, which would dry out eventually and in the joint, because they had to take lots of bits off the car to be able to get at the clutch. So I went back to the main dealer. and complain to the service manager. And you know, I was saying, you know, what are you going to do about this? And he said, well, you know, sort of, you know, I said, I'm not going to pay for it. And he said, well, you've already paid for it. And I said, shit, you know, why did I pay the bill so quickly? But then I thought at the time, I didn't know, some months later. And it was only when I got to the point where I said, okay, I'm not happy. I said, during the course of the year, I teach about 1,000 students. We add you little numbers in. And usually I have groups of 300, something like that, my lectures. There's a lot of people, okay? And I teach different subjects on different campuses, so it adds up to a lot of people. So I tell them about that particular company and how bad they are. It makes a big impact. I said, I'm going to tell them. I said, I'm completely dissatisfied. Attitude changed completely. He said, well, he said, to be honest, I'm limited in how I can deal with this. He said, the only thing I can do is pay you in future services that you don't pay for. So I said, okay, what kind of services? Because obviously you have minor services or senior services, and these very expensive services where they do all kinds of things to your car. You sort of, yeah, that happened in 5 years or something like that. I said, well, okay, how many years worth? And he said, oh, just a year. I said, no. I said, no, that's not good enough. So I ended up with getting a promise that I would have 3 years worth of free service. And I said, of course, if I'm dissatisfied with any of that servicing, I'm going to complain about it. He said, don't worry, we'll make sure that you are satisfied. So every service, all my windscreen wipers are replaced. If a bulb is beginning to dim, they replace it. The car is immaculate when I get it back. This is the power of complaint. Okay? So the more people you tell, obviously, the bigger the impact. But even you guys complaining about something which is a local service, you can kill it, which is why successful businesses, sometimes, yeah, their service starts falling below a certain level. And within 6 months to a year, they're finished as a business. They're finished completely. This particularly applies to high service level businesses like restaurants and stuff. So, how do we get people to complain? Service guarantees. Now, you have in your pack an example of a service guarantee. I view this as a pretty cool example of a service guarantee. The company is Vision Express. Do you have any branches of Vision Express in Toronto? No? Okay. You might have in Barcelona, I don't know. It's a French company. They're all over France. They're certainly in Germany, and they're all over the place in the UK. They're very famous because they said that they would do your glasses within 4 hours. You can go in there, you have a test, and they make your glasses on the premises, and they deliver it to you in 4 hours. Okay? Now, that only applies to very simple prescriptions if you want very focused or what have you, it takes longer. But look at what they're saying here. Your glasses in 1 hour. Sorry, it's 1 hour, not 2 hours. Or free delivery. And you can see this says excluding overnight stores, but no, it's simple enough. If it takes more than 1 hour, we will deliver them whatever you want free of charge. So they're saying we'll deliver it to you. Next. Are you perfectly satisfied with the comfort that appears to your glasses? If not happy with the way your glasses look or fit, we will exchange or refund within 30 days. So they put a limit. It's not 30 days is more than reasonable. Totally satisfied with your prescription. This is the makeup of your lens, the technical part. If for any reason you're not happy with the outcome of our examination, simply come back and we will do it again free of charge. Access to any frame in the world. So what they're saying is, if you like a particular frame, we will get it for you. And they say we'll do this within 48 hours. Complimentary minor repairs. So when I'm in Canterbury, where Vision Express is, if my glasses, these ones are okay, but I've got these ones that are all glass with just bits of metal hanging off them. And they tend to work loose. So I've just taken it to the store and they tighten up all the little nuts and bolts that are on there, a ton of things, and they give them back to me beautifully clean, if the box is tatty, then replace the box. So it's nice to have those sort of complementary things. Glasses made to measure. You know, if you've got a peculiar shaped face, a very narrow face, for instance, which a normal standard frame wouldn't fit, they will modify for you. Finally, competitive price guarantee. If you find the same product cheaper elsewhere within 30 days of your purchase, we will refund the difference. So very specific. So, in a way, this is saying, this is what we do as a company. Yeah, that we will make sure that you are completely satisfied, and if you're not completely satisfied, we will put it right. So,
but,
yeah?
It looks strange to me, because they are offering a lot of services, but also they assure you that they have the cheapest price.
Yes.
And they do this.
Here is the reality. Their prices are generally higher than others. Because they make them on the premises. This means it can't be done with high levels of automation in some central place. Okay, so it costs them more to make the glasses. But what they're really saying is that if you are the kind of customer that really wants cheap glasses, and you've got a pair from us and you find something which is identical in every way somewhere else, we'll do it. But most customers will not take up that price guarantee. Because they will be generally happy with the service that they're receiving. But just signalling, you know, that there's the price, but if you're not happy with the price, we don't want to be a dissatisfied customer. We will refund the difference. Now, of course, it's very difficult to compare one set of frames to another. You know, you're wearing glasses over there, I'm wearing glasses. Everyone in this room has got different glasses. You go into a shop that's selling glasses, and there's all these frames, so many different frames. Some look the same, but they're not. Every frame has got a little number in it, which actually says what that particular frame is, who the manufacturer is, what the model is. So they will be able to say, their users will say, okay, I've seen it elsewhere. They will phone that store and say, do you start blah, 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 blah? They will say, yes, we do. In which case, they will respond. If they say, no, we don't, we say to the customer, well, they look the same, but they're not the same.
So you wouldn't easily find the same product in another store?
It's difficult. Now, everyone here is wearing different set of glasses. It's because there's so much variety in the marketplace. There really is so much choice. So, what are the important features? Unconditional. We noticed that this one is unconditional. It's not saying, apart from this little comment on the back, at the bottom here, it's not making any conditions at all. Easy to understand. This one is very easy to understand, very specific, no small print. Customers know what to expect and know when to complain. You notice in measurable terms, this service guarantee puts measures in. How many days? Meaningful. It must be important to the customer in terms of what is meaningful to the customer. There's no point in guaranteeing something that customers really don't care about. It should be easy to invoke. So dissatisfied customers don't have to fill in a form. They go to the store, they just complain. They don't have to do it through a complaints department. They don't have to be given a form. They take away or whatever. You do it on the spot. So, on the spot guarantees that are easy to collect. So, we have in the UK a very big group of stores called Marks and Spencers, M&S. There's some throughout Europe, but predominantly in the UK. And Marks and Spencers was the first store in the UK to offer an unconditional guarantee. If you were unhappy with a purchase that you bought, or you bought it thinking it would fit you, or that you liked the colour, or whatever, if you brought it back to the store, in good condition, with your sales receipt, they would refund your money. They were the first store to do it. And it promoted incredible enthusiasm of Marks and Spencer's customers. They would buy things without risk. So it meant that you'd say, yeah, I really like that dress. I'm not sure whether it's, you know, whether my husband's going to like it or that I'm going to like it. And I actually sort of wear it, but you buy it, and you come home, you say, yeah, it's fine, or
You say, well, maybe it isn't, but you go back. They refund your money, you're in the store, and you'll go and you'll have a look for something else. As a result of that, it changed the industry. An example of the other side of that is my wife bought a pair of jeans for our kids when they were young. And they were washed just once, and they fell apart. My wife took them back to the store and said, look, I bought these, here's the receipt. I washed them and they fell apart. And the first thing that was said to her is, how can we be sure that these are the jeans that you bought from here? And she said, well, it's got your label inside it. And they said, well, okay, but you know, how can we tell that you've actually sort of washed this 10 times? She said, look, I bought it here, I washed it some 2 weeks later, and it fell apart. Well, your kid might have been living in it. Now, I'm sorry, we can't offer you a refund. My wife, of course, never bought there again. They told lots of people about it. But that was pretty standard. That was rude when dealing. But on the whole, people did not have unconditional guarantees. They more than the fact that they give you a form to fill in. If you're not happy, fill in a form, put the product back to our complaints department, and they will deal with it. Obviously, the absolute opposite. We want people to complain, so we want service guarantees to point out what it is that we do. So, what are the benefits? Well, I think the benefits are absolutely terrific, because if you do have a service guarantee, it encourages people to complain. But more than that, it tells you and your employees what it is that you're supposed to be doing, what you're promising your customers. So, it forces a focus on customers and what they want. It's not us saying, this is what customers want. We're saying, it is the expectations of customers that drive this. We set clear standards. We generate feedback and recovery opportunities. Because every time there's a complaint, there's an opportunity for us to put it right. Forces you to understand why you failed. So, you have a service guarantee. You've got the number of points on your service guarantee, like this one. You measure over time the number of times each one of these comes up, okay? And you chart it. If you have lots of stores, like Vision Express do, you compare stores. So is there a problem at the store level? You're able to see trends. Now, are you doing better? Because you're aiming to do better and have fewer and fewer invokings of guarantees. It builds customer loyalty, as we've discussed earlier. Oops, jumped ahead. So, lots and lots of benefits. So, it requires careful crafting. Vision Express is a very good example of it. And I share your concern a little bit that that final item is on there, because they don't really sell on price, they sell on service. So I think they could quite easily leave that one out, but it is right down at the bottom. So, to conclude, we have this cycle that we looked at earlier. This is the cycle of success, the employee cycle, broader job designs, more empowerment, training and empowerment of frontline personnel so that they're able to do a wider range of things. They understand how to deal with complaints. Above average wages, intensified selection effort in the way that we suggested, extensive training, employees satisfied with a good service, positive service attitude. And this means lower turnover and higher service quality. So, what are the benefits? Well, we get higher customer satisfaction, continuity, loyalty, low customer turnover. This means that we are spending less money on getting new customers. This means retention being a very important aspect, and overall higher profit margins. So that's where we conclude this lecture. We're going to have a break now, and we're going to look at another totally different subject area, which is research in the area of quality management.